Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. A reporter will detail her experience as her child learns remotely during the pandemic. It's been a challenge. We'll also get an update on the University of Illinois. It's been able to keep students on campus thanks to a testing program, but that doesn't mean there haven't been some lessons learned along the way. This past week saw another anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. We'll look back on an incident involving the president in Springfield a year earlier.
There were two young men. They were in a second story floor of a building somewhere downtown. As the motorcade passed by that building, an Illinois Department of Public Safety employee saw a rifle and a scope sticking out the window.
And we remember the late singer-songwriter Steve Goodman, Chicago's very own. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the University of Illinois has relied on a mass testing program this semester. We'll find out some of the lessons learned. We'll also hear from Western Illinois University's new president about the challenges facing his school. And we'll learn about an incident in Springfield involving a president and a gun. That and more this hour on Statewide. Well, there's a lot of concern about students being out of the classroom. Many education leaders say young students, like preschoolers, are missing out during remote learning. And it's not been easy on parents either. Adriana Cardona-Magiga is a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago and tells us what it's been like helping her bouncy four-year-old as he learns at home.
I've never been the most creative parent when it comes to helping my two kids with homework, but I proudly hang their drawings on the refrigerator. The best ones later go to the memory box. With my older child, I relied heavily on school to teach her how to write her name, count, and sing the alphabet. But now, with my four-year-old, the pandemic and remote learning has forced me to become that creative parent I never was.
¿Me puedes decir, Juno, cómo te llamas?
Juno Cardona Magiga.
¿Cuál es tu color preferido?
Blue and red.
¿Y en español cómo se dice?
Rojo en azul.
Spanish is my first language, and I want Juno to be bilingual. He started preschool this fall at Inter-American Magnet School, a dual language school on the north side. After we got past our early struggles with technology, we thought things would be smoother. But Juno wasn't that into it. He got easily distracted by his toys, the sound of the garbage truck passing by, our cats, and his attitude changed when I asked him to pay attention.
Okay, ponte feliz, okay? Mira.
Like all preschoolers in CPS, he's supposed to do at least 60 minutes of live instruction. There are two optional classes, including Spanish conversation and PE. I made Juno participate in everything at first, regardless of how much we both struggled. He's been learning the letters of the alphabet, drawing things that start with that letter. When he learned about the letter A in Spanish, I tried to make it relatable to his favorite toy.
The automobile. Diga pues. The automobile.
But it hasn't been easy. My husband and I are busy working from home, and my daughter is in college learning remotely. The more we push Juno to focus, the less he wants to participate. I can't imagine what it's like for other parents with kids in older grades. My colleague Susie Ann's six-year-old is a first grader at Von Linné Elementary on the north side. We chatted the other day about the high expectations of remote learning on young kids and us parents. She says it's sometimes hard to see other kids in her son's class doing exactly what the teachers ask.
My kid does not even get out the notebook because he's like, I have some toys here that I'm going to play with, and I'm just not going to listen to what the teacher is saying.
Yeah, That's how Juno is. I'm always telling him, like, you raise your hand. You know the answer. Maybe I know the answer.
In my case, Juno's teachers noticed how disengaged he was and recommended I pull him out of the optional classes so that he would have a better attitude in the main class where he learns the most.
I was worried. I really wanted him to be in the Spanish conversation class like some other kids, be more engaged. So I reached out to teachers for tips.
All kids are different.
Saskia Benitez is a preschool teacher at Belmont Cregan Elementary on the Northwest Side.
We have to let the parents know, you know, you can never compare. You know, every kid has their own unique way, you know, their own way of learning, their own way of expressing themselves.
I knew that, but I didn't quite put it into practice when I saw that Juno wasn't as involved as other kids in his class. There was other advice.
Maybe do a weekly prize for him. Give them a goal, okay? So if you do your work, you know, if you spell your name correctly by yourself, you know, today I'm going to give you a sticker.
Susie also uses that strategy.
But, like, we've broken it down to, like, attainable goals. So, like, you know, can you get ready by yourself in the morning? Can you pay attention for most of this hour? If you can, you get a sticker.
She got this tip from a teacher last year, and it seems to work for her.
I'll tap the sticker chart. I'm like, you know, I won't say anything. I'll just tap the sticker chart. Like, come on.
Susie gives her son a small prize at the end of the week, depending on how many stickers he has collected. It could be a plush Pikachu doll, a slime kit. Benitez, the teacher, also stressed we the parents need to be overly excited, make learning fun, and most important, be patient.
Instead of, you know what, you're doing it wrong. You know what, here, this is how you do it. No, a lot of kids don't know how to hold a crayon. A lot of kids don't know how to hold a pencil. You know, and show them, okay? So this is how you hold a pencil.
So I went to the dollar store, got a dry erase board, markers, lots of stickers, and some prizes, Hot Wheels, slime, a few lollipops. I told June about the sticker system, the rewards at the end, and things improved.
Vamos a escribir la O mayúscula. Hace una O grande acá. Muy bien.
I can see an O. Also this, O.
I also showed a lot more excitement and less frustration when he didn't want to draw or participate.
Buenos días.
Canto yo.
Things got a lot better from their own, but it's still hard. It's our second job, teaching, which has helped me understand even more the important role teachers play.
Buenos días.
In 2 months, Juno has learned so much. He's more willing to speak in Spanish. He confidently counts in both languages and sings songs. We're still unsure about in-person learning during a pandemic. I can tell Juno wants to interact with his classmates off the screen. But for now, we're trying to make it work, hoping he won't be too far behind when the pandemic is over. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
The University of Illinois Urbana campus initially predicted that its mass testing program and other mitigation efforts would keep the total number of COVID-19 cases on its campus to under 500 this semester. But the actual number of cases rose much higher, to more than 3,800, with the vast majority occurring among the 35,000 students living in Champaign-Urbana. To understand what lessons have been learned throughout the process of reopening the campus during the pandemic, Christine Herman spoke with U of I epidemiologist Becky Smith.
College-age students are most likely to have asymptomatic or what we call posse symptomatic cases, which means they have very minor symptoms, if any. So we know that the majority of our cases, if we had only tested the symptomatic, we would not have found them. Now, that means that we found a lot more cases than most people did. So it looks like we have a lot more infection going on because we found so many cases. That said, we found more cases than we wanted to, in part because there were more cases than we would have liked. And we've learned a lot in the process.
So let's pick that apart. What have been the biggest lessons, and what are the things that maybe you would have done differently with hindsight that you have now that might change the way things go moving forward into 2021?
So I think the biggest lesson is that technology cannot save us from a pandemic. We have to have culture working with the technology. Being that University of Illinois is a very tech-heavy campus, we went all in on the technology, and then we're picking up the culture pieces as we go. And really, it would be better to work them together. And moving forward, that's what we're doing, that we're working in concert with the social scientists and with the communication experts to try to build everything together.
So when you say that's technology, you're referring to the testing piece, but also the use of the app for exposure notifications. And the culture piece, can you tell me what you mean by that?
So the culture is the people following the guidelines. It's compliance we talk about. I don't like the word compliance because it sounds like we're putting down rules and everybody needs to comply, which really what we want to do is give guidelines that help people keep themselves safe. We want to empower people, give them what they need to keep themselves safe. Unfortunately, there's a culture in some groups on our campus, and not just students, but some groups on our campus have the belief that this is not a risk for them. And so they are choosing not to follow our recommendations or guidelines because they don't see the point. Some of the countries that have done the best at controlling this virus have been countries in which, rather than the individualistic mindset that Americans have, they are countries in which care for the community takes priority.
So how do you bake that into a strategy for COVID mitigation?
This is a major question that we are thinking about. And I mean, you've possibly heard the quote from Dr. Fauci. He said, "I don't know how to tell you that you have to care for other people." So this is something that everybody at all levels of pandemic control know, that in order to control the pandemic, we have to care for other people. And we have to make those choices. And I don't know how to make that happen. But then again, I'm on the hard science side. I'm not a social scientist. So that's why we're bringing in the social scientists and the communications experts to understand, before we can actually change people's minds and attitudes about how to keep everybody safe, we have to understand why they're making the choices that they are. So we've got a team that's actually working on talking to students, doing surveys, doing interviews and focus groups, just to try to understand, why do people make the choices that they do?
That's U of I epidemiologist Becky Smith. She spoke with Christine Herman. Western Illinois University's new president says the school has a good 10-year strategic plan in place, and he thinks he can provide the leadership to see that plan through and help Western improve. Rich Egger reports.
One issue the plan addresses is enrollment. Western currently has about 7,500 students. Dr. Guiyu Huang says the strategic plan calls for it to rise to 10,000 by 2027. Huang believes Western can hit that mark if it's aggressive in recruitment and retention.
Now, of course, achieving the enrollment goal depends upon many factors, right? You know, resources, human resources, financial resources, program availability, and also, even more importantly, the demographic shift we have seen throughout many parts of the country. Fewer students are graduating from a high school. Therefore, fewer college goers currently and in the near future, which means we need to more aggressively recruit students, not only in Illinois, but also in the neighboring states and even internationally.
Well, with a smaller high school graduating classes, what do you do to convince those students that Western is a place they should come to?
Yeah, Western does have, a very good breadth of programs. Many of them are traditional liberal arts programs, now we have, the university has a number of professional programs. So both on the main campus in Macomb and at the Quad Cities campus. I think those programs can be strengthened. On the one hand. On the other hand, the university has a tremendous opportunity to increase its distinctiveness in programs and its distinction in the quality of existing programs. So that's one thing I want to look at in terms of growing enrollment. Another very important issue I would like to look at is student retention. Western is doing a fine job retaining students, but we can even do better by focusing upon removing the barriers to student retention. Of course, the students themselves have a responsibility to themselves to come to Western, stay here, work hard, and graduate in 4 years. So a lot of the things that we can do to grow enrollment.
One of the challenges facing the campus is systemic racism on campus and in the community. How do you go about addressing that?
That's a very important topic. And if anyone's listening there, students, faculty, staff, in my many years of professional life, it's a zero tolerance policy I hold dear. Racism is real. You see that here and there. I was a victim of racism when I was a new student in another state. I had a carload of people driving by me in the street and throwing an egg at me and landed on my shoulder, shouting things, right? I've experienced racism firsthand. It should not be tolerated. This issue will be a major priority on my list when I land on campus in a couple of months.
Do you feel you've been subjected to racism, maybe even in more subtle forms, in the time since the encounter you mentioned earlier?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm Asian. There are all kinds of stereotypes of different groups, including Asians, right? You name the thing the right way. Overt racism is easier to deal with because it's overt. But subtle racism is harder to discern. And that's where the battle should be fought. People should not look at individuals from other racial or ethnic groups and judge them because of the color of their skin, the texture of their hair, or the way they dress, the way they speak their language.
Dr. Guiyu Huang is the new president of Western Illinois University. He'll take the reins in January. Rich Ugger reporting.
Just ahead on Statewide, we recall a singer-songwriter and a baseball fan. While he's no longer with us, a song he crafted for his favorite team continues to be played. We'll hear more about it next. This is Statewide. Despite the pandemic, Major League Baseball played their season this year, even though fans weren't in the ballparks. At Wrigley Field in Chicago, while there were no fans, what has become a team anthem was still played following victories. Member station WBEZ produces a podcast called Curious City, where listeners ask questions and reporters seek out answers. And this week on Statewide, we'll listen back to an episode that featured reporter Jesse Dukes along with Alexandra Solomon, and it focuses on that song and the songwriter, both of which are pure Chicago.
Okay, Alex, I'd like to start us off with some sound.
Go, Cubs, go! Okay, Jesse, I hear it.
So, you can pause it.
Pause it.
Do you recognize this sound?
That is the song. They sing at Cubs games, and I believe you have to win, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yep, you're absolutely right. It's Go, Cubs, Go, and they play it over the public address system at Wrigley Field if the Cubs win a home game. But there's actually a little bit of a dilemma. It was actually spotted by our question asker. It came from Nick Bruner, and he noticed something in the third verse of the song, which many people don't even know, but it goes...
Baseball time is here again. You can catch it all on WGN.
Alex, did you catch the problem?
I know that WGN doesn't broadcast the baseball games anymore.
Exactly. The problematic line is you can catch it all on WGN, which is not true anymore. And in fact, the Cubs haven't been on WGN radio for a few years now. But WGN TV has been their broadcast home for decades, and that is no longer true as of this year because the Cubs are launching their own network, Marquee Sports Network. And, you know, the Cubs probably don't want to promote a rival broadcaster in their own stadium. So Nick, our question asker, wanted to know, what are the Cubs going to do about that? So you could get a super fan maybe to write another song or rewrite the song, but you could not get the original songwriter to rewrite it, who is Steve Goodman. So here's his story. Steve Goodman was born in 1948, grew up on the north side of Chicago, and his biographer, Clay Eel, says he was a Cubs fan from the beginning.
His dad would take him to Wrigley. He would skip school to go see the Cubs. And you got to understand, this was a time when the Cubs were not drawing very many people. They never won.
This was peak lovable losers Cubs. And in fact, I just looked this up. He was born in 1948. The Cubs did not have a winning season until 1963.
Wow.
So until he was 15 years old, he never saw them have a winning season.
Yeah.
Steve started getting into music when he was pretty young. He sang in the choir at his temple.
He was a boy soprano.
He played guitar in a kind of high school folk band.
You never, in high school, never saw him without a guitar.
Went off to college.
But didn't last there very long because he didn't like to go to class. He would rather play his guitar.
And right around this time, he's 20 years old. He is not feeling very well. He goes to the hospital, and he is diagnosed at age 20 with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Very scary diagnosis. The prognosis for people who got diagnosed back then was maybe 6 months. You know, there wasn't really an effective treatment. But they were just starting to develop these new cancer treatments, and he signed up for an experimental treatment, and after several months of that, the cancer actually goes into a remission in the summer of 1969, and that's really when he decides he's done with college and he's just going to focus on being a full-time folk musician.
You know, we all get these little signals in our life. It's sort of like being at a light, and the light either turns red or it turns green. Mm-hmm. You know, just have to wait for the light sometimes.
Pretty quickly, he could make a living just playing songs, singing songs in a handful of bars around Chicago. There were all these clubs, and they were really just kind of like bars, like places where, you know, maybe you could get 50, 60, 70 chairs. You know, there was the Earl of Old Town, which kind of became his home.
Our own Steve Goodman!
Some performers would just get up and sing their songs. Steve would do that. He was a virtuoso guitar player, but he also was a storyteller.
Wrote this song after I walked to the bottom of the Grand Canyon in 1975. Just got back.
He talked about the Cubs a lot and how terribly they were doing. That was kind of a theme.
The Cubs, now they haven't won during my lifetime, and I'm not that young.
He just charmed everybody.
Good night. Thank you very much.
Okay, so, you know, by the early 1980s, Steve is making his living as a folk singer, as a musician, and he's pretty successful. And he's lived, you know, 10 years longer than the original doctors would have predicted. You know, he's in his early 30s. But he still has two goals. There's still things that are eluding him. And one is that he's never had a hit song on the charts where he's the performer and the singer. Other people have recorded songs he wrote and had hits. You know, maybe most notably, Arlo Guthrie, the son of Woody Guthrie, had a number 4 easy listening hit with the City of New Orleans. The country singer David Allen Coe had a country hit with You Never Even Called Me By My Name. It kind of makes fun of country, but it made it onto the country music charts.
Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song.
But he was never the singer on those hits up to that point, and, you know, it's clear that he may have been a little frustrated about that.
Why didn't he have a hit?
Well, there are a lot of possible reasons, but his biographer Clay Eels has a theory. Back in the 1970s, he was discovered by the country singer Kris Kristofferson.
Goodman was being handed the brass ring. You know, would you like to come to New York to start a recording contract? Most anybody in that circumstance would say, gee, yes, thank you. But the first thing out of Goodman's mouth was, well, if you think I'm good, you got to hear my friend John Prine.
he had this instinct towards generosity, and I'm not sure that always worked in his favor.
That kind of generosity is more of a great life lesson, but it doesn't necessarily translate into becoming the household word, you know?
Yeah, he was too nice a guy.
Yeah, maybe he was just too nice to have a hit. So that was goal number one, and moving on to goal number two, remember, Steve loved baseball.
I've been trying to write a song about baseball for 4 years, and I get about 3/4 of the way through it, and then I walk somebody and take myself out, you know? I never get to finish the damn thing.
It's a baseball metaphor. You know, it basically means failure.
It's true. I get about 3/4 of the way through it, and then I'm struggling. You know, it's a hot afternoon, and I'm looking to the bench, and the manager comes out and yanks me.
So he's been trying to write a baseball song for years, and finally, in 1981, he wakes up in the middle of the night with this vision, this dream, and from that comes a song called A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan.
What you're seeing is a video of Steve playing the song live.
An old Cub fan lay dying.
He's up on a rooftop with his guitar. He's got a bright blue Cubs hat on. You can see Wrigley Field in the background. You can even see the infield grass, nice and green.
They knew his time was short.
It's about this lifelong Cubs fan who is dying.
He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest.
And he's telling his friends and family how he wants to go.
He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day.
And the song also really makes fun of the Cubs for losing all the time.
But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups? Year after year after year. After year after year after year after year after year. Until those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore.
That's intense, actually.
What's intense about it?
Now that I know about his diagnosis, it feels like it's autobiographical and that he's talking about his death.
Yeah, it does. It sounds that way. But, you know, when he wrote the song, he was in remission. He had been more or less cancer-free for 12 years. But between the time he wrote the song and this video was shot, the cancer had returned. And I think you can actually see it in the video. You know, even though he's smiling and he looks happy, it looks like he's lost some weight, you know, and he probably knows at this point that the leukemia is back and it's pretty serious.
When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy. Now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave.
So that was Steve's first baseball song, and pretty quickly it becomes a crowd pleaser at his shows and kind of a local favorite in Chicago. And in fact, the local TV station wants to film him performing it at Wrigley Field. But the Cubs wouldn't allow it. They said no. And the reason was the song pokes fun at their propensity to lose. And they didn't like that. And this was a time when they were trying to rebuild a team and they were focusing on winning. And they just didn't want that lovable loser's crap in their stadium. So this is where Dan Fabian comes into the story.
Talking into the receiver.
Dan Fabian was a radio producer at WGN.
Yeah, radio.
And one time while he was at work, he saw Steve Goodman on the radio, you know, like doing an interview or performance.
And man, the light bulb went on.
Fabian had been looking for some bumper music for the WGN Cubs broadcasts, like stuff to play in between the innings. And so he saw Steve Goodman there, and he had this idea. What if Steve Goodman writes a song?
So anyhow, I literally ran to the studio, scribbled a little note, went in and slipped it to him during a commercial.
Hey, do you want to write another Cubs song? I like Dying Cubs Fans' Last Request. Would you like to write a happy Cubs song?
That was on a Tuesday. He came back Thursday with a guitar and with the bones of the song. And the following Monday night, Tuesday morning, we had a party. a little studio just south of Wrigley.
Goodman just like rounds up a bunch of his folk singing friends.
I think a couple of the Cubs were actually part of it too.
Baseball season's underway.
And they just knocked the song out.
And what was your involvement with the recording? Were you producing?
I'll have you know I'm the high squeaky voice in the background.
Oh, you sang?
I told you it was a party. Anyhow, we recorded it, and 3 weeks later, it was on the air.
And the Cubs liked it. And this year, the Cubs, this is 1984, they're actually doing really, really well that year. And they say, you know what, if we make it to the playoffs, Steve Goodman can come and sing the Star Spangled Banner. He's not going to sing the Dying Cubs fan song, but we'll let Steve Goodman come and sing, you know, to kick off the game, because we love this song. And the Cubs actually do make it to the playoffs for the first time since 1945. But Steve Goodman dies of leukemia 4 days before that. But that's actually not the end of the story. So you remember I told you he wanted to write a great baseball song, and you know, arguably he wrote two. Do you remember his other big goal?
He wanted to have a song that he wrote himself, that he performed, that would be a hit.
Exactly. That song, Go Cubs Go, was used by WGN for a few years, but then it kind of got forgotten.
Mm.
You know, you were talking about the Cubs playing it at the end of every game. That's a relatively recent tradition. That started in 2007, which was also a big year for the Cubs. Somebody at the Cubs organization said, hey, remember that old song from the 80s, Steve Goodman, all that? Why don't we dust that off and play it after a home game win, and we'll see if people sing along. And
they did.
They sang along. It caught on. It became this big tradition at Wrigley Field. It also caught on in the bars. You know, people would sing along. And then in 2016.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series! Bryant makes the play!
Go Cubs Go got a lot of attention. Bill Murray and a couple of the Cubs sang the song on Saturday Night Live. The cast of Hamilton in Chicago sang it, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were singing it in Grant Park at the Victory Parade. There were something like 2 million streams on Spotify, and it went up on the Billboard charts.
Wow, and that's like, what, 30 years later, he finally gets a hit that he sang.
And, you know, Steve Goodman fans would say it's kind of ironic because Go Cubs Go is not what they would consider to be one of his best songs. But Clay Eales and others say Goodman would have appreciated the situation. And yeah, it's sad that he didn't live to see it. But if you think about it, it's also kind of the perfect story for this song. Because, you know, for most of Steve's life, the notion that the Cubs are going to win, baseball season's here again, you know, it's time to start a whole new day. All of these lines are about optimism in spite of all the available evidence. And I think that resonates deeply with Chicago Cubs fans. And I think that, sorry, I'm getting emotional. I think it's also, even though it's a pretty simple song, it is also kind of the essence of Steve Goodman, too.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in that clip I played for you, and you see all those people singing the song, you know, full-throatedly, and they've got signs that say, this is for Grandpa. I think Steve tapped into that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think there is that dream that somehow they'll succeed someday, and people not giving up on that dream. I do think it's real, and I think it's kind of like the spirit of the city a little bit. Chicago, we're not New York, but we're gonna matter too.
Yeah.
I do think it's a part of the spirit of the city itself that's captured in that idea.
So maybe, you know, you could see why it might be a little bit difficult for the Cubs to think about rewriting or reperforming
yes.
the song.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I see why now it's not such a simple thing. So what are the Cubs doing?
Well, they have said they're going to continue the tradition. But according to Clay Eales, Steve Goodman's biographer, it doesn't actually matter what the Cubs do.
The song is going to survive any ownership change, any radio change.
Because the fans will be singing the song no matter what.
I mean, Go Cubs Go, I think, is forever.
Thanks to reporters Jesse Dukes and Alexandra Solomon of WBEZ. This episode for their Curious City podcast was produced by Stephen Jackson and Linnea Dominic. They shared it with us here on Statewide. That piece aired earlier this year on the program. Stay with us. There's still more to come. This is Statewide. Stay with us. We'll hear about a little-known incident involving President Kennedy in Springfield a year before his death. But first, misinformation about COVID-19 has sometimes spread faster than the disease itself. Chase Kavanaugh looked at some of the reasons why in this report.
When it emerged earlier this year, the world had limited knowledge of the coronavirus and its full effects. Doctors and researchers worked to better understand the disease, but countless rumors also circulated. Peter Adams with the News Literacy Project explains.
Like self-test, you know, if you can hold your breath for 10 seconds, you don't have it, and that's entirely false. Or, you know, if you gargle with water, you can wash the virus out of your throat. That's false. So those kinds of false claims circulated quite a bit.
These small claims can escalate to much larger concerns when somebody gets sick, including how they seek treatment. That's what Dr. Brian Pastinchian, hospitalist medical director at Delmar Hospital, is seeing.
Some people who are waiting and delaying routine care or even urgent care are presenting with more advanced problems that perhaps may have normally been the case pre-COVID.
Expert information on COVID-19 may appear sporadic and contradictory. This, says Pastinchian, is a factor of time.
Typically, you've got months to years to gather data. And, you know, with COVID, you've kind of been operating on a much, much smaller time frame to determine what's best, what works for patients, you know, what may not be as effective.
Confusion can also come from a misunderstanding of how scientific research is done. Nicole Ledoux is a professor at Northern Illinois University whose work includes training future science teachers. She says issues can arise when people are presented with news reports of studies that contradict each other.
When there's new findings, that is often picked up because it's exciting. But in the scientific community, you would find that if there's one finding that's quite unusual, that the rest of the scientific community would be pretty skeptical of that finding.
Ledoux emphasizes that science is an iterative process. Skepticism, in this case, prompts further study.
They might change a particular variable, and they might find, you know, that finding, while it was true, when we put it in this new context, we find out more information that contextualizes that first finding.
But even with a proper understanding of research, there's still the matter of people trusting the information that they find. Adams with the News Literacy Project says over the past decade, people have been consuming a greater proportion of opinion content.
That has caused people to just echo the talking points that they're hearing all day, every day, and people are really failing to distinguish between opinion journalism and straight news reporting.
That's not to say opinion journalism doesn't have a role.
People who know subjects very well, who engage in honest debate, who, you know, take positions that are well-reasoned and thoughtful, that plays a role in the national conversation, but we still need a shared set of facts about which to have a debate.
Ledoux says this should also be taken into account when judging suggested courses of action regarding COVID-19.
There are a lot of economic consequences and personal consequences to following the guidelines presented by scientists. And when we group those things together, that makes people point to the scientists as they're the problem. They're not the problem. The data is the data. What we choose to do with that data is a different question.
Ultimately, a large part of combating disinformation comes down to distinguishing opinion versus fact. Ledoux says this can depend on the nature of the research behind a report.
I look at who has done the study. Is that study funded by a company that's profiting off of the result? I look at, did that finding have a control group or a comparison group? So did they vary a variable?
And how information is presented.
Trustworthy information doesn't actually ask you to trust it. It shows you why you should.
Pastinchian at Northwestern Medicine says patient knowledge is improving.
Unfortunately, sometimes people just don't know how they were exposed or when they may have acquired it from. But we've seen varying spectrums, you know, from very little knowledge of anything about COVID-19 to kind of people who really do a good job reading up on it.
And the hope is that greater scientific and media literacy can help fight the flow of misinformation. I'm Chase Kavanaugh.
this past week marked the 57th anniversary of one of the most tragic events in U.S. history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It happened in Dallas, Texas in 1963, but what few know about is an incident here in Illinois, in Springfield, just a year earlier. The president riding in an open vehicle when a rifle was pointed out of a building above. Crystal Thomas is a former reporter with the State Journal Register. In 2018, she wrote an article about that incident, and we talked with her then, and today on Statewide, we revisit that conversation. Crystal, thanks for being with us, and let's start by explaining Kennedy's visit to Springfield. What was his agenda here?
Well, so Kennedy was visiting Springfield as a part of a stop during a campaign tour. The midterms were in a month, and he was in Springfield to stump for Democratic candidates, namely Representative Sidney Yates. He was here to give a rousing speech to a crowd of thousands of people in Springfield, urging them to vote for his candidates.
So he comes to Springfield, and a motorcade ensues once he leaves the plane at the airport. How did this come to your attention? How did you find out that there was something that occurred during that motorcade?
Well, so on the 55th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's actual assassination, the Washington Post ran an article by Professor Stephen Knott. This professor actually got these declassified documents from the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston that explain this incident. He was the one who found that this incident actually happened. We didn't know about it for so many years because it was sitting in that document that was still classified until 2 years ago.
And your newspaper at the time just had a brief blurb that something had occurred.
Well, I wouldn't even call it a blurb because it was two lines on page 7. It wasn't even part of the main story. It was part of a story called Kennedy Sidelights that was explaining kind of the police presence it took to protect President Kennedy and to secure the motorcade. And the two lines didn't talk about how there was a rifle pointing at President Kennedy at one point in the motorcade. All it said was that two youths were arrested and that they were held for Secret Service. There was no follow-up and no explanation for why they were arrested.
So talk about the rifle itself, and somebody, of course, witnessed this. Do we know who saw it, and what did they say? What did they describe seeing, and of course, what did the investigation turn up?
All we know about this incident so far is what was found in that biweekly report that was declassified 2 years ago. The report is about it's about 20 pages, but the brief about the motorcade is about a paragraph. And what it says is that there were two young men. They were in a second story floor of a building somewhere downtown. And as the motorcade passed by that building, once it left, an Illinois Department of Public Safety employee saw a rifle and a scope sticking out the window. And from there on, local police went and got the two youths, arrested them, and brought them to Secret Service. They were questioned by Secret Service. They had admitted that they did stick the rifle out the window at the presidential motorcade, but their explanation for doing so was that they wanted to see if they can see the president through the scope of the rifle so that when he came back through the motorcade 30 minutes later, they could see him better. They weren't prosecuted. They were, however, their rifle and the ammunition was seized.
There was never any follow-up that we could tell. No information was given by the police or the Secret Service to the local media.
Not to the local media. And it's pretty curious because I couldn't find anything in any of the Illinois State Journal's pages following the incident. There's nothing about it, according to the declassification archivist at the JFK library, in any of the documents she's looked at. There also isn't a trace of it in Springfield lore, which is what I kind of find the most interesting part, because there were locals who were involved in that arrest. There were police, there were sheriff's deputies, things like that. Maybe people who were on that motorcade route that saw something. And yet somehow this this incident didn't trickle down to some kind of rumor or some kind of far-fetched story that people tell their grandkids.
We're talking with Crystal Thomas, a reporter for Springfield State Journal Register, and we're talking about JFK's 1962 visit to Springfield. Some new information that's come out regarding an incident during the motorcade in which a rifle was apparently pointed at the president. When we mention two youths, I believe 16 and 20 years old, were taken into custody, eventually not charged with this. You were able to track down at least one of these people.
Yes, he actually still lives in the area. He was 16 at the time, but now obviously he's much older. I paid a visit to his house on Saturday because I couldn't track down a number for him, and I knocked on his door. He opened his door. His small dog came out, and we chatted for a bit. There's no way really to begin the conversation about whether you tried to assassinate a president 56 years ago, so I mostly just asked the question, showed him the brief. He didn't really want to talk about it. So what you see in the paper is pretty much everything he told me, that, you know, story's right there in the brief, and he grabbed his mail and then closed the door.
And you did not identify him because he was never charged with any crime?
No, he was never charged. Secret Service declined prosecution. We took a look at his local criminal records to see if that gave any kind of indication one way or the other that would talk to his motivation about the incident, and it didn't. There was nothing. He's pretty clean when it came to his record, and so we just decided not to name him, although he is named in the brief.
Well, it's interesting to me, this incident, even though we can't prove that there was any intent to harm President Kennedy at the time, it sort of foreshadows the events in Dallas just a little more than a year later. And apparently, though, it did nothing to stop the president from riding in an open motorcade, or at least that we're aware of, that, you know, whether the Secret Service started becoming more concerned because of this one incident. Were they realizing that he was at much more risk in something like an open motorcade? It just seems interesting to me, the close proximity of this to the actual assassination.
Yeah, the actual assassination was 13 months after the Springfield incident, and there are a lot of similarities. President Kennedy in Dallas was in an open-top limousine, similar to how he was in Springfield. You know, he was shot from above. So there were a lot of similarities between the two trips. And one thing we can't know at this point was what kind of conversations the Secret Service had or President Kennedy had after this incident in Springfield. If there were any conversations, you know, they're not in records that we can see or have been declassified. But I will say that one thing to keep in mind is that President Kennedy himself didn't enjoy bulletproof glass. He wanted to be out in the open. And one of his most infamous quotes was, you know, I'm paraphrasing right now, but if someone wanted to kill a president, they would find a way to do so. So whether they took lessons from this Springfield incident or not, there's no way of knowing if that trigger had been pulled in Springfield, if something had more aggressive had happened in Springfield, whether that would have prevented Dallas. I'd still love to hear from people who were in Springfield during that incident. I think there are so many more stories to be told. I'm sure that there are witnesses seeing the two men either being arrested or seeing the rifle scope themselves, or the Illinois Department of Public Safety employee. I think there's still a lot more to learn about this incident.
That interview took place 2 years ago, and not much more has been discovered since. Crystal Thomas, the reporter who was then with the State Journal Register, has since moved on, but we do have a link to her story about a rifle being pointed at President Kennedy during a visit to Springfield in 1962. That was just a year before he was shot and killed. You can find that link at our website, statewideshow.com. This past week marked the 57th anniversary of JFK's assassination in Dallas. That's all the time we have on Statewide. We hope you're enjoying your holiday weekend. Be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Also, like us on Facebook. Keep up with the show each week. If you want to find any of our past shows, you can head over to the website, statewideshow.com, and our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.